So this is, I'm standing out in front of the Capitol Theater. This is in the heart of Singapore. This is the Asia premiere of Sufra, which is Thomas Morgan's film, award-winning film. He appeared in Cannes this year. He's now come to Singapore, 2 nights, 1,000 seats in the Capitol Theater in a beautiful part of downtown Singapore. The lines are long, the people are here, it's starting to sprinkle outside, so people are looking a little bit anxious, but inside everybody is happy and smiling. Every nationality seems to be here, and there's also this food truck that's made out of these little wood boxes, and the food truck figures large in the movie, which we'll learn about soon. This is Inside Asia, and I'm Steve Stein. This episode finds me in Singapore, in line to see Sufra, the latest venture from filmmaker and friend of the show, Thomas Morgan. Longtime listeners of the Inside Asia podcast will know this is not Thomas's first appearance. It was more than a year ago when I sat with him on a rooftop bar in Singapore's trendy Club Street district. In part one of this two-part discussion, he told us how a midlife crisis led him to give up corporate life for a career in filmmaking. In part two, we talk about the commercialization of the film industry, the rampant rise of global film festivals, and the insatiable universal appetite for great storytelling. If you haven't heard these conversations, I urge you to do so. Visit the Inside Asia website at www.insideasiapodcast.com to listen to these conversations or download and enjoy any or all of our other 60 episodes. When we last spoke, Thomas was in the throes of completing his latest film titled Sufra, a tale of a Palestinian entrepreneur and refugee living in Beirut, Lebanon, and how she and a band of women aspired for something better. I asked him in our most recent conversation to bring us up to speed on the release of the film.
At the time, you know, like most of the documentaries that I had made, you get to this point where you're not sure if you're going to finish. But this one, I think, felt especially daunting because it was going on so long and there was no end in sight. We didn't know if she's going to get the truck. We didn't know what was going to happen. We were trying to run around and grab onto investors and try to tell a great story. But I think what was more difficult for me was I got to this point where I really felt like, is this it?
Yeah. Should and just for listeners, let's go back a little bit. The story of Sufra.
Yeah. So the story of Sufra, it's south of Beirut. There's a refugee camp that's 70 years old, Burj Al Barajna refugee camp. And a woman inside this camp decided that she wasn't going to live like this anymore. Stateless, three generations living in a camp, basically, with no hope, no potential. And so she got the women together and said, what can we do to make a living and to kind of take back our dignity? And so they were like, reluctantly, were like, well, we could cook. So she applied for and got a microloan and started a small kitchen inside the camp with some really shitty equipment and some really difficult surroundings. But it became kind of hipster to start buying from her. And so the business started growing. And then she decided she was going to take it a step further and wanted a movable restaurant, which was later defined to her as a food truck. And so from that, she had someone run a Kickstarter campaign for her and started this journey to get the food truck, not knowing, and me not knowing either when I showed up, that it would be a two-year really battle against the government.
Yeah, and knowing, having no idea whether or not this is going to turn out or not, just shadowing what you thought was an extraordinary entrepreneurial woman living in a refugee camp.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were so many times during this film that, I mean, just the Kickstarter campaign alone, you know, with 2 days left, they still were like $20,000 short. And I was like, this is going to be the shortest film ever.
And Kickstarter is a site where you could go on and you can say, here's my business objective. This is how much money I need to raise. Right. You put a little mini business plan in there if you want, or just a description of what it is. And then it's time sensitive. You're given what certain amount of day, I guess you can set the dates. And if you don't make it and cross that threshold, you get none of it. Is that correct?
That's right. Right. That's right. And it's a crowdfunding where you put in, usually there's a video or something to go with it that explains your idea and you have 30 days to get the money that you need. And it's all or nothing.
And it must have been, I mean, you know, refugees in Beirut want a truck, I mean, that's a tough concept. I mean, you really have to have a pretty compelling little piece on there. And the fact that she was so compelling, and she is so compelling in terms of, you know, how she promotes herself and the capabilities of the women, their love of food, it was probably a key driver for them winning and ultimately earning the amount needed, which I think was something over $46,000-$47,000. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, she tried to get $46,870, if I can remember exactly. And then she ended up getting like $70,000, but it was all in the last 2 days. Like, it just picked up amazing steam and it went well beyond. But even I, with like 10 days left, was really doubting that this was going to happen. And then really contemplating the ridiculousness of what this was. A woman who doesn't drive in Beirut, who she doesn't even cook, trying to get a food truck.
Yeah, no legal status.
No legal status, yeah. Trying to start a business. Like, yeah. Maybe this wasn't the best campaign to launch. Like, maybe it's not going to work.
Or the best idea for a documentary.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So that was a story. But then again, back to, you know, what I said earlier, a year ago, you had spent pretty much all you had and raised as much money as you could. And you still were coming up about $20,000-$30,000 short just to finish the film. What happened since then?
Well, it was more than that to finish. I think we were, you know, it ended up being like $100,000 to finish because it just kept going. You know, at the time we thought $30,000 would get there. We showed what we had to a company called Pilgrim Media out of Los Angeles. And Pilgrim Media, interestingly, Craig Piligian, who started the company, is not a documentary film investor by trade. He does reality TV. He does, you know, Ice Truckers. He does films like that. So the fact that he was so moved by what we had that he put the rest of the money in was really a miracle in and of itself. And they were great partners because they understood how long that took. They understood that we were following the story, and they understood that there was a really unpredictable ending. But they were willing to kind of jump in and take the risk and take the journey with us. And so we were hugely fortunate.
So in the world of documentary filmmaking, once the film is done, now the marketing campaign begins. You begin submitting your film to film festivals.
Yeah. So we started out and we thought we would get into Toronto, and we didn't get into Toronto, and then it just becomes this, you know, and also, again, there's so many times that you doubt what you've done, and you're thinking, oh my God, I put 2 years into this, now it's not going to go anywhere. So we premiered at a new festival in Egypt, and the reason we picked that festival is because it was one of the places that we knew we could get Miriam to for the premiere, and it was an amazing, the El Guna Film Festival was absolutely over the top, amazing festival. And we won a couple of awards there. And then it just...
But Miriam, as a refugee, had a hard time getting an exit visa and sometimes was at risk of not being able to return to Lebanon, which was always a concern.
Yes. But the organization that... And the two brothers that started the film festival in El Guna, they had a great relationship with the Lebanese government. And so they were able to kind of help take care of that as well. So that was a huge win for us. And then we won a couple of awards there. Miriam's there. And then it just kind of took off. We went to Doc NYC. We went to Berlin. We were selected for a special category at Cannes because you're supposed to premiere at Cannes, but we didn't premiere at Cannes, but we still got in on this other, you know. And so then it just kind of started snowballing, and it just kind of took on a life of its own.
And we talked about this before, about the whole gaming that goes on with the film festival industry. I mean, they're always trying to outdo each other. Everyone's got their own kind of player and their own positioning. Now there's kind of subcategories of film festivals. There's hundreds, if not thousands of them around the world now, aren't there?
Yeah, it's like 4,000 film festivals. Yeah. It's really ridiculous. But it is a very... I mean, there's people who make their living strategically figuring out where to put the film and what festivals and so on and so forth. But what happens is once it starts going and once you get into some of these top tier festivals like Berlin or Cannes or whatever, then you just start getting acceptance letters for other festivals that you've never even applied to.
Yeah.
So it's just like now it's just like a, you know, it's wide open and you're just picking which ones you want to go to and seeing, you know. And for us, like for me especially, this was the first time that because there were so many festivals that were asking for the film that we were able to charge a screening fee. And so you're actually able to start in a small way recouping some of the cost of the film at festival, because most of the time festivals are an expense.
Yeah. So. And you showed up here in Singapore for the Asia premiere. You had the Capitol Theater here. You had two nights, an afternoon and a night. The Saturday night, there was close to 1,000 people. On Sunday, I think there was also a huge turnout. And you had some interesting angles on this, including a local chef that was involved in promoting it. And you also had a cookbook that was produced from which the proceeds will go towards Miriam and her plans for the camp.
Yeah, so we, ultimately, so Rebel House is the company that I started with my partner Trevor Hall in Los Angeles. And then we have a Rebel House Asia studios, which is here in Singapore. And the idea was, if we were going to bring it here, how do we make it feel like an experience? So the chef was just somebody who grabbed onto this cookbook that we had made that we're selling, the proceeds going to building a children's center inside a refugee camp, which they said would never be done, which we've already built. And now we're just trying to get teachers and desks and so on and so forth. But how do we make this feel like an experience? And so we had, it was almost a bit carnival-y, but it was fun, and people showed up. And what I was really most amazed at is the enthusiasm that the audience kind of came in with, because there was all of these other things going on, that they didn't just show up for a movie and then they walk out after the movie, but they got to see other local social entrepreneurs. And so they were really able to feel like they were part of something that was bigger than just the film itself.
But that's very much of your agenda, this filmanthropy, the idea of generating a film, creating a call to action, somehow allowing the movie to then generate returns for an organization that's trying to make a better world.
Yeah, I think we never think of it when we go into the film, like we never kind of put our finger on it and say, how are we going to change the world with this film? But we always make a film that we feel like could change the world once we figure out what the film is about and exactly how we're going to do it. And so it is very, we want it to be more than the film. We also don't want the film to feel like it's a public service announcement. We don't want it to feel like it's something that we're doing for, because we want you to give money to something else on the back end. We just want to make a film that after it's done and people are sitting in their seats, they ask the question of themselves, what can I do to help?
Yeah, and he's to stand on his own artistic merits.
Yes, and if nobody ever does anything except tell other people this is a great film, that in and of itself is a win.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to my interview with Thomas Morgan, documentary filmmaker and storyteller. In the second part of our interview, I shift gears and get him to talk about the film industry and the possible impact on Asia with the debut of the blockbuster film Crazy Rich Asians. For those of you listening who haven't seen the film, here's a clip.
Singapore, for spring break. Colin's wedding. We've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. Come on, don't you want to see where I grew up? Meet my family, my ama. I meet up with that strange college roommate of yours.
Picklin?
Mm-hmm.
She has been begging me to come visit her, you know.
The universe has spoken. It wants you over there. Come to Singapore. I want the whole island to meet the brilliant Rachel Chu.
I'm speaking to Thomas Morgan just 3 weeks after the release of the feature film Crazy Rich Asians. In that time, box office receipts blew past the $100 million mark and show no sign of slowing. For Hollywood's first all-Asian cast film, that's a major accomplishment and signifies a recognition that the subgenre of Asia-focused films is here to stay. Gaining global recognition has been a four-decade endeavor for the Asia film industry. There have been moments. Who doesn't know and love Jackie Chan's unique mix of martial arts and comedy? And what about Bollywood and its high-energy song and dance routines that have captivated audiences well beyond India? Still, Asia-based films have floundered more than flown when it comes to universal appeal. How about The Great Wall, starring Matt Damon, a U.S.-China co-production that flopped at the box office and threatened the prospect of future collaboration? It had it all, a big star, special effects, lots of kung fu, but it left moviegoers cold. What is it then about a quirky tale of wealthy Asians living in Singapore that made Crazy Rich Asians a box office smash? Is this the case of a single lucky break, or is this what the future of film in Asia looks like?
There's so many different pieces and parts to that particular film. And it, A, it was a great book. And so people, if you have a book that's a winner, it's, you're pretty sure that people will show up to see the film. But, you know, I also think it was Hollywood patting itself on the back a little bit. Like, we're going to be diverse. And especially in a time in the United States where it's very difficult to point to any diversity in anything that, that you're proud of. And so this was this kind of, I think, attempt at that. But I think here in Asia, it's not accepted the same way, especially in Singapore. You know,
yeah, explain that.
You see a lot of Chinese people playing the parts of the rich Asians, and then the Indians playing the security, or, you know, other people playing servants to the Chinese community. And so for the community here, that's not the makeup of Singapore. That's not who Singaporeans are. That's not how it works.
So have Singaporeans who you've spoken to voiced frustration or concern about that?
I think there's a lot that are very outspoken, especially if they're not Chinese. I think there's a lot that feel like, you know, wait a second. Yeah. And it's kind of like, it's like whitewashing it in the United States. You know, like, that's the way they feel here. But on the flip side of that, I also feel like it is a bit of a breakthrough, because it's kind of proven that with a diverse cast, with a film like this, you can make money. And I feel, and I don't know how any of this came about, but when you have a growing Chinese market and you have a population now that's watching films in Asia that's surpassing that of the United States.
And we're talking about well beyond Singapore. We're talking about the greater China market, all of Asia Pacific, you know, something in the range of 3 billion people.
Yeah. And so you've got this huge market, and suddenly, and film has gotten to be a big, big deal, that this is a way to break into that market.
With an all Asian cast.
And honestly, with a cast that wasn't as well known, and that probably cost a tenth of what it would have cost to put someone like Matt Damon in the film, or someone like, you know, Brad Pitt in the film, or someone that, you know, playing the part of the Asian, the white American, you know. So I feel like, you know, this was a way to kind of test those waters. And I also feel like it was time to test the waters, because so much of the money for U.S. films is coming from Asia. So they had to figure out a way. How do we keep everybody happy? And we prove a model that the Asians feel like they're represented and that their voices are heard, and maybe this turns into something that's more of an opportunity to break into that $3 billion.
So that's right, Tom. So a lot of the money going into just your general Hollywood films is actually coming out of Asia.
I don't know what the percentages are, but it's a very, very large amount. And most of my friends who work on scripted features will tell you that they go to Asia first, because there's much more money in Asia and they're risk takers and they'll figure it out and whatever. And so I think that's where the money's been coming from, Asia, for a while. Like, so for example, you know, companies like Tencent that are just massive compared to the U.S. studios, you know, like they're looking for, what do we invest in that we can get our money back in a market that we know. So we know China. So, you know, we want to play in the United States, but we want to be able to sell it into China as well.
It begs the question, how long do you think the Asia money has been urging Hollywood to do something that's most primarily focused and filmed and produced in Asia?
Well, but I think like anything, right? If you're a novice investor, you follow the lead of the expert. And I think that's what the Asian money has done for a long time. They've just followed the lead of an expert, being Hollywood.
Right. So we'll give them money, and whatever they feel they want to do with it, I'm sure there's a high probability, or at least a probability, it'll be successful.
Yeah. The idea that they're smarter than we are. But I think what's happened slowly, and now much more quickly, is that they see the market and the market potential in Asia. And I think this really was also an opportunity for Hollywood to say, hey, we care about you too. We're going to make a movie that you can sell in your own country. And I don't know. We'll see how it all shakes out. But I think that it was really an important time for them to break into this and see if it worked. But, you know, and then the fact that it is all Chinese, interestingly, I think that's the way the U.S. thinks of Asia. I think they just think it's all Chinese, because there are more Chinese than anything else. But I think that really is it's problematic, like in a place like Singapore. It's problematic when you make those films and they don't really represent the culture that you're making them about.
I guess when Hollywood's involved, there's always the danger of stereotyping, right? And so now if this is the average American's view of what, you know, Asia is all about, you know, wealthy Chinese living in Singapore, so be it. I don't know how we're going to change that overnight. But it does mean that in some ways, you know, just back to that earlier point about financing and about how, the way this works, does this now give license to a lot of the Asia money that previously had been feeding it into Hollywood and now say, you know what, maybe we don't need Hollywood. Maybe, you know, we have a robust and a capable Hong Kong film industry. Mumbai is a big, you know, generator of films.
Oh, Indonesia. Right. Indonesia is, I mean, it's huge there. I mean, I've talked to a guy in the U.S. that has a company now that's based in Asia because they're filming so many things in Asia. And I think that there is an appetite for when they, now that this market is kind of feels more open, that there's an appetite for more production of Asian-based, Indian-based films. I had one of the guys that I spoke to, who is of Indian descent, said to me, and he's a very wealthy guy. He said, "I'm going to make crazy rich Indians," you know. And it's like, but the idea that he's even talking about whether he does it or not, that he's contemplating investing in a film because he sees the market potential, and it's his way of you know, talking about his culture, talking about where he's from. Yeah. I don't know. It's just, it's an interesting time for sure.
You know, I see an interesting parallel here because, you know, we talk about Silicon Valley and how, you know, is it possible for Asia and particularly for China to create, you know, our recent episode was on Silicon Dragon, you know, the idea that China could reinvent Silicon Valley in China, you know, bringing in enough talent over time, investing, putting enough money and R&D behind it, see what happens. And clearly there's some brilliant and incredible companies coming out of China now, world-class technology companies. Could the same be true for films? I mean, is this just a matter of staying the course, putting enough money in, hiring enough talent, bringing enough great screenwriters and filmmakers that actually Asia could really just take off from this point forward?
Oh, I think it's a huge potential. I think it's a huge opportunity right now, because I think the other thing that's happened in Hollywood and not just Hollywood, but a lot of more mature markets is they've become very complacent. They've become very, this is the way we always do things. And if you go to the cinema, you see there's not a lot of risk taken anymore. But I think the opportunity is for writers who maybe aren't as well known, but are very good writers, for actors who maybe aren't as well known, who are very good actors, and will be given that opportunity now in an Asian market. And I think that could change everything. And suddenly, you know, the guy who's in second or third place, you know, catapults himself to first, and everybody else is chasing behind. And I think it's a very, very possible reality for.
So instead of go west, young man, it's go east, young actor.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But I also think that, you know, the Asian wealth is willing to take more risk. You know, the big studios aren't huge risk takers. That's why they just keep making the same things over and over.
Because they've come to enjoy a certain level of, you know, return, and they've got shareholders, and there's lots of, you know, eyeballs on every single box office receipt.
And everybody's trying to keep their job, right? Everybody's just, you know, at the end of the day, who's going to take a risk when you know you can do this thing and it returns the same thing every single time? So why would you go out and make some statement or make, you know, take any kind of risk? But I think that that's all going to change, because when everybody else starts, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's like any big company, it's like any, and it's massive, and it's Hollywood, and it's always been, and it's, you know, but slowly, you know, this market is chipping away at that, and it will falter.
But just to push back a little bit, I mean, Crazy Rich Asians was very formulaic. I mean, it really did hit all the romantic comedy notions, and it had the key themes and the right players, girl meets boy, mother objects, you know, I'm not going to ruin for people who haven't seen it. But, you know, in many ways, it was formulaic. And could the message be to Asia filmmakers, hey, stick to that tried and true formula, that's the answer, versus being more risk-taking?
You know, possibly, but I doubt it. Yeah. I doubt it. I think it was more of an experiment to see, will people show up in the United States to watch, you know, this other huge market, to watch Asian on a screen. And honestly, that's part of the reason that we, that Rebel House has an office here, because we want to be on the pulse of what's happening in Asia, because we feel like there's great potential here. There's great potential to take more risk. There's great potential for stories that haven't been told, that aren't the same stories that you've heard over and over again in Hollywood. And I think there's great potential for collaboration. And so having an office here makes total sense for us.
One of the challenges, at least to date, in Asia has been finding great storytellers, great screenplay writers. Somehow, there's just hasn't had the same kind of vibe. And again, you know, back to the Silicon Valley example, you know, you could say that, you know, companies tend to copy. I don't want to stereotype on this, but as opposed to innovate, is with this film industry and with what's just happened and what continues to happen, is there an opportunity for, you know, a new generation of screenplay writers to come in who now are liberated to take more risks, as you're pointing to, do things they might have otherwise held back from doing? In other words, the capability to write is there, but the license to do so has been suppressed.
Well, I think what's going to happen is, I think it's going to feel like back in the 70s or the 80s, when there was a true independent filmmaker market, when it wasn't all under the roof of these big studios. I think people are going to look at the $10 million film and say, that's a risk I'm willing to take. And it's a completely different story, you know? And so those stories will set a new course for the way that stories are told. And at right now, it does feel very formulaic, because it is very formulaic. Mm. But I think that all of this will change, and that we will push back to the truly independent films, which will also change the dynamic of the festivals. It'll change the dynamic of what festivals are truly independent film festivals. Like this Elguna Film Festival that I had mentioned in Elguna, Egypt. It's truly an independent festival. Mm. It's very, very well funded. It's mostly Arabic based, but they are like willing to put so much money into bringing new stories there. That will change the dynamic of the way that other festivals operate, because it will surpass many of these top tier festivals very quickly. First of all, they give away thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in prize money. That's unheard of in festivals. And then suddenly, I mean, you're getting everyone who wants to, you know, start to recoup, and also knows that you'll have the press there to make a name for them. So
you're speaking to the burgeoning of an ecosystem, an entire ecosystem, a support network, you know, in order to underpin the growth and development of films across Asia.
I just think that the industry has been so stagnant, people will also point to me and say, oh, there's just, sour grapes. That guy hasn't gotten what he's wanted. I totally appreciate that. But just from an outside perspective of the way that the industry works, it can't sustain itself the way that it is. Nobody's going to want to see 10 more of these kind of films. And that's why I think the Netflix and the Amazons and all of that has picked up, because suddenly they're telling stories in a way that you're not seeing them on the screen anymore. But I think now it's going to start changing differently. I think now the independent films will start coming out, and they'll probably start coming out of Asia. This is where the money is. This is where you can get decent tax incentives to do it. You can get cheaper labor. And I think there's huge potential.
Thomas, you and Rebel House have a foothold in Asia, here in Singapore. I suspect we'll be seeing more of you in the weeks and months to come.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Sure, sure. Great to be here.
This is Inside Asia, and my guest is documentary filmmaker Thomas Morgan. We've been talking about his newest release, Sufra, as well as the rise of the Asia film industry, which brings me to the Asia Insider Minute, that part of the show where I try to summarize some of the key takeaways from the conversation you've just heard. Let's start by saying that culture is hard to pin down and hard to change. Anyone who's worked in change management, really anyone who has tried to change the way that anyone does anything, knows that there are challenges involved. We live in an age of digital disruption, but we also live in a world populated by people who are bound to their culture, which has a curious way of being both apart from you and apart of you. It's hard to identify an overarching theme of a podcast like the one you're listening to, but if you had to try, it would maybe start there. The story we're telling on Inside Asia is one about the way in which people are slowly, and often out of necessity, changing the way they think about Asia. Tech innovation, AI, healthcare innovation, e-marketing, mobile payments, robotics, you name it. The days when innovation was understood to move from west to east are over. There's a steady two-way flow now, and I'd argue that the film Crazy Rich Asians is just one more addition to this chapter in the story. While there's big Hollywood money behind the film and Warner Brothers claim distribution rights, its nexus is absolutely Asian. Based on a book by a Singaporean writer, directed by John Chu, an American but of Chinese heritage, and starring both known and fresh Asian talent, that all speaks to the dawning of a new era for the industry. The film's ambitions, like those of Asia at large, are global, not local. Thomas Morgan tells us this shouldn't come as a surprise. It was only a matter of time before the confluence of Asia money, Hollywood commercial savvy, and Asia talent aligned to generate a hit. The audience, he tells us, has been there all along, patiently waiting. The real story behind Crazy Rich Asians is that it points to the emergence of a culture of movie making based in Asia. Culture is hard to manipulate and hard to change. But another thing about culture, it catches up. And once that happens, well, watch out. Until next week, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.